Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And just for the sake of transparency, this is take two. We accidentally lost our connection and lost the first version of this interview, which only had one question in it, so we're all good. And this interview is about how a fourth grade teacher who wasn't really into reading blogs ended up building a profitable blog herself. Her name is Lindsay Ostrom. She is the founder of Pinch of Yum, a food site that features delicious recipes that are accompanied by stunning photos. The site is monetized through ads and affiliate programs and a little bit through membership site, which her husband runs. We're going to find out how she does the whole thing. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The first and only question that I got off before is a question I usually save for later in the interview, but we're going to start off for a reason, which I'll explain in a moment. And the question is, what's your revenue?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, a repeat of what I kind of just said, but when we started, we decided we're going to track monthly how much we could make from the blog, and it was kind of as an experiment to see if it was even possible to monetize a food blog. Actually, my husband had started, you know, to get interested in online business and online marketing, and was kind of read something that said you could never make an income from a food blog. And so he said, you know, hey, let's experiment with this. Let's play around a little bit and just see if it's possible, because I think it is. He was also following Gary Vaynerchuk at the time, who, you know, is really passionate about whatever it is that you're doing, you can make an income online from that. So he started that, and when in our first month, just to give a little bit of the backstory, in the first month that we put ads and started trying to monetize, we made $20 in that first month, and we put it out there in an income report. But now we're about 3 years later from that first income report, and these last 4 months have been 20 to 30,000 for our income in a month, and that's with, you know, our expenses taken out and everything. So we have all that on the blog to publish in those income reports. So it's a very detailed documentation.
That's why I brought it up, because if anyone goes to pinchofyum.com, they will see right at the top navigation bar, along with contact information and about and recipes and everything else that you're used to on a site like this, there's a link that's called Income, where you break down your monthly income in detail. And along with it, you've got these beautiful photos. I love the design of the site, and I love the design of the income statement that you have on there. One more thing before we get into the actual story. There's also a membership site, which we won't get too deeply into because your husband runs that. You run the main site itself. He runs the membership site, which we'll talk a little bit about later. Yeah. How does the revenue compare from that to what we'll talk about here today?
From the membership site?
Yes.
How does that compare to Pinch of Yum? Yeah, it's, you know, it's growing, which is fun. It's only, right now it's only, gosh, we started at 2013, mm-hmm. So it's really only about a year or two, you know, old. And gosh, you know, I feel like I don't feel confident enough to say like a specific revenue number as far as monthly.
No, but we don't need to specific. But is it more or less?
No,
the income?
It's less right now. Yep.
Okay.
Yep, it's less. And I would guess it's maybe at about a third of what we're at for Pinch of Yum.
Okay.
So, but it's definitely growing, and it's been really fun. You know, it's always fun because we look at. One of the metrics that we use is like the daily number of renewals, of subscription renewals. So, you know, that number, you know, at the beginning, it's like we have two people renewing, we have three people renewing, and it's $25 a month to renew. But now we're getting to the point where it's, you know, more like 10 people, 15 people, 20 people. So that's really fun to see that grow.
All right. You were a teacher. Are you someone who dreamt of teaching your whole life?
Yeah, I mean, when I, you know, was getting ready to head off to college and I was kind of choosing a career path, that was just it. That was like such a good fit for me. And I think it's in my nature to, you know, if you take the Strengths Finder or, you know, do all these personality inventories, it's just my natural self is, you know, talking to people, teaching people, helping people get new skills and that the kind of interaction that happens in teaching. So that's always been me and what I've wanted to do. And so when I graduated from college, I was able to get a job at my dream school, which is just, you know, a local school here in St. Paul. And I really loved this school, and I became a fourth grade teacher. And I was doing that for basically the whole time that Pinch of Yum was starting. Pinch of Yum was just really a hobby blog on the side, and teaching was really my main thing. I don't think I ever would have, I mean, 5 years ago, if you would have told me that I wouldn't be teaching, I would, you know, I would just...
And in many ways, absolutely. You are actually teaching right now, too.
What's that?
In many ways, you are teaching on the site right now, too.
Right, for sure.
The reason that you started the blog is because you felt that you were annoying your friends on Facebook. How are you annoying them?
Well, I just think, you know, I love to find recipes online and share them. And I would, a lot of times what I would do would be to go to a blog or go to a, you know, website, a food, I really like Cooking Light, so I would go to their website. And then whatever I would make, I would upload a picture or like, you know, share the link to my friends and say, hey, this is what I made. It was so good. This is what I liked about it. This is what I changed. And I just wanted to talk to people about food was what I was finding with that. But, you know, when you're following somebody and they just kind of on Facebook and they keep sharing all this stuff, I thought, oh, people are probably getting annoyed that every single night, I'm like, look what we had for dinner. You know, look what I made.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. So that was kind of what I, that tension was kind of what, you know, inspired me to just jokingly one day I said, maybe I should start a blog so I quit, you know, I'm not annoying all my friends so much, but I can still get that outlet of sharing, you know, what we're making and what I love to cook and eat. And then we went for it. So
you used, you went from Facebook to what platform to launch the blog?
Yeah, we started on Tumblr.
Tumblr.
So at the time, I mean, I don't know where Tumblr is, you know, considered now, like in the, you know, ranking of all the different blogging platforms. But at the time, it was really kind of like the hot new thing. And so we felt like it would be a good fit. It could be like kind of quick little snippets of things being published. And so it was a good place to start. It was free too, you know, so that was a good place to start. I also feel though, you know, if we, that's one of the regrets we have. If we were to go back, I think we would, if we were to do it again, we would start on WordPress right away just because it's a more, I think, sustainable, it fit our needs better as far as like developing a blog that was a business. But Tumblr was a great starting place. So,
you know what? One of the reasons why I like Tumblr as a starting place is because it's so easy that it eliminates the friction of sitting down and trying to pick the perfect design, of deciding what plugins, of deciding all this other stuff. At least you get started and then you could always transition over to another site, which you did. You took, in the early days, one post would be a photo, the next post would be the recipe, or I think it might have been vice versa. Why did you do it that way?
Well, I think I was just so clueless about blogging and blogs and how people consumed them. I mean, I would use blogs for searching for recipes and finding them, but I really didn't follow any blogs. Like, I wasn't a blog reader. And so I don't think I really understood, you know, how people want to consume content and that it doesn't make sense to separate those in two separate posts. Also in Tumblr, you know, and in a lot of blogging platforms, I think it is, you know, there are these different bells and whistles and buttons and things where it's like, do you want to publish a quote? Do you want to publish a photo? Do you want to publish text? You know, and so I was just very straightforward, like, now I want to share a photo and then that's its own post. And now I want to share text and that's its own post. I think I was just so clueless about the whole world of blogging and how people consume that was just what made the most sense to me at the time, which is kind of funny. But
was your goal at all to make money from the site back then, or was it just to share recipes?
Absolutely zero thoughts about money at the beginning. I mean, I didn't even know that was possible. And I don't even know if really Bjork was thinking about that at the time. I mean, he's the one that kind of inspired that to get started. But in the beginning, it was, I mean, I didn't even have a concept of like growing traffic or anything like that. It was just like, I'm going to have this fun place where I'm going to put things and then, you know, then they're going to be there. And that was about as far as my understanding or goals went. So no, definitely not. That was not a factor when starting.
And then what got you excited enough about it to continue?
You know, I think one of the big things for me was there are these food sharing sites that, you know, will kind of curate all these different bloggers' photos and their recipes and then link out to them. So food lovers can go to these sites. One of them is called Food Gawker or Taste Spotting. And then you could go, it's kind of like a Pinterest, but just for food. And then they will, you know, feature different things that they like. And I would, even though my blog wasn't that popular, I would get featured. And because of that, I would start to see more people coming to my site. And that was so motivating to me. I mean, I would go, like, we'd go somewhere and I'd get arrive and quick run to the computer and check my analytics and see how many more people had come. And I think when you know that that people are responding to what you're doing, it's all the more motivating to keep on doing it. So that was really the first motivator, even before money, was just people like this and I want to keep doing it because I get more comments, I get more visitors to my site.
And this is all Tumblr showing you all that analytics?
Actually, through Google Analytics, we were doing that.
At that point, you already installed Google Analytics.
Yeah. Yep.
Ah, so now you had a point system.
Not at the very beginning, but yeah, it was pretty early on that we had the Google Analytics.
On Tumblr?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So that's where the point system started to come in and make it into a game.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, it was like There's definitely something to say for that game mentality of, you know, this one has this one. And in the beginning, it was like 20, you know, 20 people. I'm like, whoa, this post is so popular. 20 people, you know, have seen it. And then that I'd say, oh, look at what I made in that post. I'm going to try to replicate that. What are the things about that that people like? And it's like a puzzle, you know, trying to figure out how to keep getting the points up.
So what were one of the first things that you discovered that allowed you to get those points up?
Well, I think those food sharing sites were super important to me anyways, being that I hadn't been doing it for that long. And at that time, I think those were really popular sites. And now I think the popularity of those is waning because of Pinterest, and people can have that need met through Pinterest a lot in a bigger, you know.
So were you creating, were you posting on those sites or were other people posting?
No, I would submit my posts. Okay. So I would do a post and then I would go over to this website, submit a photo and a little caption. And if they liked it, then they would publish it on their site, which had a lot of, you know, a lot of foodies who are looking for recipes. And if they really liked it, they would put it at the top of their page, you know, in the first row. And then you get a lot of traffic from that. Or
so what would you do to get them to really like it?
You know, I think a lot of it is the photos and making it look appealing, because you can have an awesome food, but if it doesn't look that good, so it would be getting the photos to really, figuring out what photos resonate with people. Like, this is getting really specific and foodie and kind of dorky, but melted cheese, you know, it's like people love melted cheese. And so once you figure out, no matter what it is, if you can put melted cheese on it and kind of take a photo of it, like stringing out, people are going to die over it.
They're going to love it.
So it's like finding those little things that, you know, people love, and also just what the food itself is. So looking at, you know, what ingredients are people liking, and doing a little bit of research as far as what's trending with food and what are people, not just what do I like, but what do people like and respond to the most.
Your photos are still fantastic. Where did you learn to shoot photos of food like that?
Well, when we started, actually, Bjork, we had a nice camera, which is totally to our benefit that we started with that. It's not anything super fancy, but it was a DSLR, and Bjork's always been really interested in photography, not food, obviously, but he would, I would cook and he would take the pictures. That was probably for like the first 3 months. And I was totally set on, he needs to be the one to do it, 'cause I don't know anything about photography. He needs to do it. And he was like, Linz, you can totally learn this. Like, you can do this. And so then it's kind of just takes somebody saying it, and then you're like, okay, I guess I can. So I just, you know, he kind of taught me the basics of the, you know, the manual settings and how to control, you know, the look of the photograph in terms of the technicalities. But then just practice, you know, and doing, I've done now over 600, you know, posts. And so over time, you just continue to get better, and looking at other people's photography and seeing what you like about that and trying to replicate that in your own. I've read a few books and taken a few classes, but, you know, that's about it. I don't have any background in photography other than just what I've learned on my own.
You know, a few years ago, I was invited to do interviews with food bloggers, and I asked one of them about photographs, and I said, what's one thing that the amateur doesn't know that you as an experienced photographer do and they could replicate? And she said, I take a lot of photos. I see most people, if they want to take a picture of their food and have it look good, they'll take one. If they're daring, they'll go to four. I take a lot more. Do you have any tips like that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely take a lot for
my... How many's a lot?
Post. Like, I would take probably 150 for one post.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to put maybe like 5 to 8 photos on my blog. So if you think, you know, you need 20 or whatever to get the one that you want, and there's a lot of tweaking, like taking it and then tweaking. For me, I guess, like in terms of actual practicality, like the secret trick, the thing that really made it click for me was the lighting, and figuring out how to get the lighting in a way that gave it a magazine-like quality. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, my photos can be as good as the photos in the magazine just because of where I placed the light. So that was a really big thing. That was a really big thing for me.
I see. And that's something that I saw that you guys teach on your membership site.
Yeah.
I got so captivated by, as someone who sits in front of a webcam all day, and I guess today we all do, or if not a webcam, then a mobile phone camera, I noticed the impact of light. I never paid attention to that before. I know you look good on camera right now because you're not flooding the light. You're not flooding your camera with light behind you. It was probably light in front of you, but not overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like those little differences are huge. All right. So you started doing that and suddenly the points were starting to go up as you were getting more and more traffic. Then you started to see that someone else put ads on their site. Do you remember who it was and why that mattered to you?
Well, we had a we had met another couple who was kind of doing the blog thing together. It was Alex and Sonia from A Couple Cooks. That's the name of their blog. And we, it was one of those like early, for us anyways, it was early on in the game where they were like, hey, you're coming to our town. Do you want to meet us in person? And it was like, you know, a big deal. Like we're going to, don't tell our parents that we're going to go to this, you know, couple's house that we met on the internet. And so scary. But we went and we talked to them about what they were doing and they had put some ads on their site. And they were, I mean, I think I had probably seen ads around the other blogs at that point, but they were really the first people that we talked to about it in person and kind of got the wheels turning for us. Bjork was really, he didn't really want to do ads at first. He thought, you know, he's much more business minded than I am, or at least has more of a background in that just from his own personal interest. And so his idea was, you know, we're not going to go with a network. We're just going to advertise for our own products. But at that time, we didn't have any of our own products. And so it was kind of like, well, let's just give it a try and see what happens. And we started with this like really lousy, I don't even remember the name of it now, but it was some really lousy, you know, ad network that was specific to food bloggers and it made hardly any money, which, you know, you can see in the first income report was like $20 or whatever. But yeah,
Why didn't you give up at that point? Why didn't you say, hey, you know what? Maybe you really can't make much money with food blogging. You can only make money if you teach people how to make money. I should get out of this. Why did you keep it up? I'm looking at that first post. It's $21.97. At that point, why didn't you say, it's not for us?
I think when we started, we had a long-term mentality. It wasn't, I think both of us knew that it wasn't a get-rich-quick kind of a thing. And I don't even think I had any concept of like, this could make substantial money. Cause I remember at that point thinking, I mean, honestly, I thought if we make $100 a month, I will have arrived. Like that will be it. That will be amazing. I can't wait till we make $100 a month, you know? And so I think for me, part of it was just being naive about it and not really understanding how low that was in terms of what the potential was. And I think also we both just had a perspective from the beginning that this is like a long-term game. This isn't like you go put ads on your site and then poof, you make all this money. That's enough for you to leave your day job kind of thing.
Yeah, it took me a long time too with Mixergy. And I'm seeing that first post where you guys are talking about, is that Bjork who wrote this one?
Yes, he writes all the income reports.
Okay.
So that's kind of, you know, how we share a pinch of yum. I mean, really, it's like, I would say it's like 90% me and then 10% him just doing those income reports. But it just makes so much more sense for him to do it. And he really likes doing it. And I think it's nice, too, because with a blog, you know, there is an element of, like, personal connection. And it is a little bit awkward to, like, talk about money publicly. And I do get emails from people that, you know, they say, hey, you're really rude. You shouldn't talk about that online. But I think there's something nice about the separation of, like, it's not the voice of the blog saying, here's food, 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 and money. You know, it's like, I talk about food, and then he comes in for people who are interested and says, hey, if anybody else is out there working with, you know, their spouse or whoever on monetizing their food blog, here's how we do it. I think that separation is helpful for us anyways.
I liked his analysis of the first one. He's basically saying, yeah, we made a little bit of money. It's very little, but also we lost a lot of the design of the site and we turned it over to strangers. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's okay that there's an Activa ad, it's yogurt, but then this Spanish ad suddenly appeared on our site and we had no control over it. And so, all right, I see the opportunity and I also see the challenge. By the way, I feel like there's something going on with my, oh, I know what it is. I'm wearing a thicker t-shirt underneath this shirt today and it's riding up in the back. And I figured maybe my collar's turned up awkwardly or something's going on.
Funny.
All right, good. I'm glad I addressed it. That is the important thing for me to bring up. all right, so you continue to do income reports. This running Spanish ads through this network wasn't the solution, but you hit on affiliate programs. How did you discover affiliate programs?
Well, Bjork was a big follower of Pat Flynn, and so both of us, you know, kind of were at that point, you know, he was like, hey, look at this. This is really cool. And I was like, what in the world? That's so crazy. I can't believe that's real, you know, real life that people are doing that.
Because Pat Flynn was showing his income reports too and making a lot of money.
Yes. And I think a big part of that is his, you know, affiliate stuff. I don't know. I don't, at this point, you know, what the breakdown will be, but that's kind of where I know that's where the seed was planted in our heads. Like, hey, one really a strong monetization strategy is when you start teaching other people, you know, and recommending products and the whole affiliate marketing thing. So that's when we started. It's a funny story, actually. Bjork, one morning before, you know, he was working at a nonprofit, and before work one morning, he was like, you know what, I'm just going to get up early, you know, get up at 4:30 a.m. or whatever. I'm going to go to a coffee shop, and I'm going to just make this page. And it's going to be all about how to start a food blog and teaching people how to start a food blog in 3 steps and put a affiliate link in for Bluehost, and, you know, so people can sign up to get their hosting and their domain and everything. And that page is like the single most, you know, income earner for Pinch of Yum. And it's, we joke about it, like he spent 3 hours on this one page, and now his all day and all of our time is spent on these other things that don't even make a fraction of what that one single page, you know, has made over all the years. So that was kind of like the start of it. And then that's really the main, as far as affiliate marketing, that's really the main thing. We don't have a ton of affiliate links, and we're in Minnesota. So as far as like being an Amazon affiliate, we're kind of, you know, cut out of that whole picture. So
Your number one affiliate program is Bluehost.
Yes.
That's something that I think anyone can sign up for if they just go to Bluehost and become an affiliate, right?
Yes. Yep.
And
yep.
I think even for Pat Flynn, he kept showing his revenue numbers month after month. I think Bluehost for a long time was his number one source of revenue, his affiliate program with them. And for you today, it's still number one, but it doesn't make up more than even 25%. It's roughly 25% of your revenue.
Yep.
Do you remember how you celebrated when you saw that one's actually producing?
I remember because I really did, honestly, I had that $100 a month benchmark in my head. Like, I thought that was going to be the ultimate. And so I remember when we, you know, the first month that we made that much, it was like, okay, now we go out for dinner and we get to have a nice dinner out. And, you know, in my mind, that's what it was. It was like, when we make this much, you know, a month, then we're going to go and spend it on a nice dinner out. And that's all it's going
to
be.
But there was no sense of, when I get to this number, I'm going to quit my job because I hate it.
No, I mean, that was like, I think the time when that really started to enter my mind was when we actually lived in the Philippines for a year. So during the year that we were in the Philippines, which was 2012 to 2013, that was when the income from the blog started to surpass, you know, my normal teaching income here in the States. And it was like, oh my gosh, you know, we're making more doing this than I am from like going to work. And how much more could that be if this was my full-time job? And so that was really when the idea first came into my head. And then even after it did come into my head, I didn't necessarily want that. You know, I've always loved teaching, and it was really hard for me to, it was just now like 3 months ago that I left, you know, finally decided I'm going to leave my job and do this full time. And it was a hard decision. So,
yeah. You know what? It's not directly related to business, but I think it's interesting to hear why you ended up in the Philippines. Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my siblings, I have 3 siblings adopted from the Philippines, and they were adopted like maybe 5 or 6 years ago. They're older. All 3 of them are, you know, biological siblings, and they came they were adopted from an orphanage in Cebu City, Philippines, and it's called the Children's Shelter of Cebu. And so we had connections, you know, through our family and through our church. Like, we're actually high school sweethearts. We grew up in the same hometown, and then
and Bjork did.
Yes, yes. And so the town has itself, you know, and the churches and everything have a lot of connections to this orphanage. So they knew of us, we knew of them, and they needed a teacher for a year. And they have a lot of Filipino teachers, but they usually look for at least one American teacher, because many of the older kids are adopted to the U.S. and they have an American studies course that they want someone who's a native English speaker and who understands the culture that, you know, can help the kids kind of prepare for that. So they asked us. We actually were planning to go just for a trip, for a visit, because Bjork had never been there. It's a big part of my family. And then we were going to go for 2 weeks, and they called us about, it was maybe like 2 months before we were supposed to leave, and they said, hey, how about you guys come for a year instead of 2 weeks, and you can teach and you can live here and work here? And so we said yes. And then we like sold our cars and rented our house and kind of sort of quit our jobs and flew over there and lived there for a year and worked, and it was a like an amazing experience. So,
and you were saying that it's where your siblings lived before they were adopted.
Yeah,
and then they were adopted how long ago?
I was about 5 or 6, maybe coming up.
Oh, you were 5 or 6 when they were adopted.
No, like I was an adult. I was like grown out of the house. But Bjork and I were married already. You know, so
that's what
this
I
was like.
So your parents at that point said, "Let's adopt more kids. We're ready to have more."
Right. So my my youngest biological sister was just getting ready to leave for college. And actually my family had taken a trip there and met these three kids prior to adopting them and just felt connected and felt like, I think my parents had, you know, were feeling like they were up for the challenge of continuing to do the parent thing and have kids around. And so, so that's how they ended up here and in our family. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, I've noticed that there are a lot of entrepreneurs that have gone away somewhere, and by being in a different place, they got to focus on what they cared about, and they had a new perspective on life, and that helped their business. Is that what happened to you? What is it about the Philippines that allowed you to change course with this business?
Yeah, well, I think it was really interesting when we left, because the blog was starting to pick up. I was super excited about it, and we had no idea how moving to the Philippines would affect it and if we would be able to continue that, you know, have it grow and what that would be like. So we really left for the Philippines saying number one priority is teaching and working and like kind of living life, you know, and working with this orphanage, but we would really like to keep the business going if possible. Well, at that time it wasn't really like a full-fledged business, but, you know, like to keep the blog going if possible. And so we got there and it was like, I had no idea, are we going to be able to get the ingredients we need? You know, are we going to have internet? And are we going to, you know, am I going to be able to take the pictures? And it was really surprising to me how it continued to grow. I thought if I can just maintain it, I would feel really good about that. But it continued to grow and to get more traffic and more readers.
Why did being in a foreign country where ingredients were harder to come by, why did that help?
I think a couple things. I think the story element of it was appealing to people, and that's really when I started to embrace that a little bit more. Up to that point, I really hadn't shared much about, you know, our personal life. It was all strictly recipes. And I think when we went, people started to say, oh, that's so interesting. I love seeing your pictures of the kids there, or I love seeing pictures of, you know, where you've been. And it made me realize that, you know, part of having a blog, or at least for us, kind of the direction we wanted to take it, isn't just like mass producing recipes, but it's wrapping it up in terms of like developing the brand as our personality and our story, and not trying to hide that, but showing that and kind of like letting people into that slice of our lives, and that people really responded well to that. So that was more in terms of like the reader, you know, like reader loyalty, I would say. But as far as like getting more traffic, another part of that was that we really didn't have much of a social life. I mean, we're like, you know, we didn't have a ton of friends there. We were really busy, but it was kind of a way for us to connect to life back home, was to work on the blog.
So I see. Like, and there were none of the day-to-day distractions that we might get bogged down by.
Right. I mean, there were challenges, but, you know, those distractions of like, now I'm going to go on this trip, or I'm going to do this with my friends. It was kind of like, come home, and now this is what we do, and this is our connection back home. And it had a different kind of significance, I think, at that point.
I do see that even from the beginning, there was a photo of you on the site with a description of you as a teacher, pug lover, and a dessert enthusiast. There are photos of Bjork, your husband. Mm-hmm. You were very open. I also see that in the beginning, the design didn't look nearly as good as it does today. It had, where was that? Like a share button that was a little weird. It also had really nice design. Like the header had this script pinch of yum in it that looks well designed, had drawings of fork and knife and spoon, but at the same time, there's a picture behind. Where did you guys learn to design like that?
Oh, well, I mean, that was like, that header, you know, with the fork and the spoon and the scripty, that was my first ever like attempt at, I'm just going to do my own little header. So I don't know that I really, that there was anything learned about it.
What software do you use to design that?
I use Photoshop.
Photoshop. So yep. To know Photoshop, to me, it means that you're a designer in some capacity, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I really, at that point, that was like my first ever, you know, interaction with Photoshop. And Bjork, again, like a lot of this stuff is just personal interest for him. So he had a lot of the skills, and we had Photoshop already, which, you know, that's the place to start. And I remember going to other blogs and kind of looking at the headers that I liked, and then going around and searching for like the little vector images that I could, you know, copy and paste and put together. But I was so proud of that. I mean, that took me forever to make that dumb little, you know, super simple little
script text. I think it looks nice. It is very simple. It doesn't look nearly as nice as what you have today, but I thought it looked really good, and I assumed that you had a design background. So here's what I'm getting from talking to you before the interview started and hearing throughout. I get the sense that you're naturally creative, but you work at it to get better. And one of the ways you work at it is by seeing what's out there. I get the sense that Bjork loves researching stuff, mm-hmm. right? He's a Mixergy fan who loves yes. studying Mixergy interviews and understanding yes. what other people did. You guys both looked at Pat Flynn and other sites, and you're constantly hungry for new information.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, in terms of our partnership, that's really his strength, is the research, the kind of like the directional thinking. And I'm more of like the, I'm just going to get in and do it and actually like produce something. So I feel like in that way we work together. We always say like, he's the, you know, at the steering wheel and I'm the one pushing the gas pedal. Like I'm the one doing the work, making it move forward. And he's really saying what's the next, you know, what's a good strategic decision for where we're going next. But we've really, I feel like with Food Blogger Pro, he's, you know, that's now he's posting every week and, you know, really actually making things happen instead of just being the idea guy. And I'm becoming more of an idea person by, you know, dabbling in things like Mixergy or, you know, kind of getting more into that business side of it. So it's been a really good partnership. And I feel like our strengths have kind of come together and merged to complement each other. So, and I feel like that's a theme that I've heard in a lot of the Mixergy interviews, is just as far as partnership goes, to be able to complement each other and kind of spur each other forward in those things that you
can. Yeah, absolutely. Most people are lucky if they spend a long time searching and they find someone who they could work with for a couple yes. of years like that, and yes. you're married to them.
Yes.
One of the experiments was an ebook on food photography. How yep. did you know what, and that was the first product that you created, right?
Yep.
How did you know that that's what you should create first?
Well, actually it wasn't. We first had the idea, yeah, let's do this ebook on food photography. I'm self-taught. So, and because I'm a teacher, you know, I feel like I could teach, but I was really intimidated by it. I remember telling Bjork, like, I don't think I have enough credentials to really write this book. And so then I was going to do a e-cookbook. And then actually what happened was I went to a photography class and I kind of realized, like, wow, I know all of this stuff. Like, I already knew this. I just didn't know that it was the knowledge that people need to know. And so at that point, I realized, you know, I really could write an ebook and teach people not only what I know, but just from trial and error, you know, experiment, and how I feel like it's really powerful to be able to show these are my ugly first photos and then these are what my photos look like now, and that people can relate to that. You know, people can relate to, like, this is where I'm at and this is where you got to, so I can do that. You can help me do that too.
How did you know that your audience would want to buy a book on food photography as opposed to a cookbook, which most people would have assumed?
You know, I think it was kind of, when looking back, it was a smart decision because, you know, when you're doing an ebook, you want to do something that solves a problem for people. And the cookbook isn't quite, I feel like it's really hard to make that work on a food blog because people are already coming for free recipes. And, you know, it's just harder to market that. But honestly, there was no strategy really involved with it. It was just kind of saying, people comment, they say that they like the photos, you know, and it's a skill that I have that I'm developing and I'm interested in it. And it just happened, kind of luckily, really, to be this really awesome fit where a lot of people who were coming, you know, were interested in growing their own blog, improving their own photography. And that kind of tied in, too, with the income reports because, you know, people were coming saying, how are they making money? I want to learn. And then it kind of developed that learning section of the blog. And so it's so funny to me when I think about where I was at when I wrote it and how far it's come and how much income it's brought in. I mean, from this one little ebook that I wrote on the nights and weekends of my life, you know, it's just really, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Is that the ebook that's still producing right now, Tasty Food Photography?
Yes.
That's the number one source of revenue on the site, apart from the membership, which is a whole other product.
Yep.
Number one, above even Bluehost. So it seems to me that one of the reasons why you knew that would work is I'm looking at your site from back then, and there's an ad for Bluehost. There's a link, a beautiful looking designed ad that you created yourself that links to the page where you tell people three steps to start their own blog, which again is an affiliate ad for Bluehost. And then there's a thesis theme affiliate ad there. So it seems like you were experimenting with revenue through affiliate programs and ads. And when you hit with Bluehost and thesis, you might have realized, wait, we have an audience of people who want to start blogs like ours. Yeah. That's the market intelligence that wasn't explicit, but you did absorb the information and the knowledge. And that's what told you, these people want to build a blog. They want to build a business like ours. In order to do that, we needed to know photography. They probably will need to know photography too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like it's, you know, it's kind of that, and maybe Bjork had more of that idea in his head. And for me, it was kind of like, well, I'm just going to write an ebook. What should I write about? But I think that subtly, you know, was developing already with, as far as what we were starting to talk about more and how people were responding to it, because people did respond really positively. And we were seeing, you know, income from people, you know, clicking on the affiliate links and getting their own blog started. So that was definitely, you know, I think that was definitely a factor in deciding to do that.
You spoke with April here on the Mixergy team about what the launch looked like. And when she asked you about that, you said it was pretty lame. I'm looking at her notes here. Why did you tell her it was lame? What was lame about it?
You're talking about Taste Food Photography now, right?
Yeah, launch of that.
Yeah, it was, it's totally been learned through experience. Like I didn't any research on how to launch a product or anything. It was like a couple weeks before it was done, I put a little post out and I said, hey, does anybody have any questions that you want me to answer? I'm going to be releasing this photography book. And then I got a few comments. And then the 2 weeks later, then I just pushed publish and was like, hey, here's where you can buy the book. And that's that. And we really didn't do that much as far as like intentionally building up to it. Or even after it was launched, it was kind of like it just sat there for a while. But I think the thing that has allowed it to continue to be successful, even though we really were lame about the launch of it, is just the affiliate portion of it, and that it is a helpful tool for people. And it's so easy for people to share that because it's truly valuable to them, and they can.
You mean the affiliate component where you have an affiliate program, and anyone who refers traffic to the book gets a cut of the revenue you make from the book.
Yes, yep, and we do 50%. So that's, you know, I think hopefully a good incentive for people, and I think because it's genuinely helpful to people, and they get to the end of the book, and there's just a little blurb at the end that says, "Hey, if this book was helpful to you, you know, you can share it on your site, and we'll give you 50% of the
referral." And that was built in from the start.
You know, that's a good question. I was just thinking about that. I don't know if it was or if we added it, you know, maybe a few months after. Okay. I don't remember for sure or not. But I know, you know, for most of the life of Tasty Food Photography, that's been a part of it. So
let's not overlook what you said before, though. You said, before I even sat down to write it, I did a post on the site asking, do you have any questions about photography? And that, I'm imagining, helped you uncover issues that people had and a sense of where they wanted the book to go and how it would fit in their lives. Did it get you the kind of information you were looking for?
Yeah, I think at the time it was like an afterthought. You know, now if I were to do it again, I would do that at the very beginning and use that to help me guide the whole direction of the book. Mm-hmm. But I had really written the book for the most part at that point. And so most of it was done. I was just kind of putting it out there to see, is there anything else that I've missed that anybody wants to know about? And then, you know, maybe there were like three comments that I was like, oh, that's a good point. I didn't put anything about that in. And then I went and added something, but it really was an afterthought. It wasn't a strategic, you know, part of the initial thing. And now if I were to do it, I would do that right from the get-go and really be intentional about asking my audience about.
Why is it that if you were to sit down and write a book right now before you started writing, you would go onto your site and say, what do you want to know?
I think because, and I've experienced this with the last two ebooks that I've done, which have just been e-cookbooks. And, you know, it's like, why didn't I ask people if they wanted that? Because now I made this, it took me forever to make it, and nobody wants it. You know, like nobody, it's not as successful of a thing.
That's what happened with the cookbooks.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, I don't think it's like an all hope is lost and that was such a waste of time, because part of the process of doing that was learning how to make an e-cookbook so that we could teach people how to make an e-book or how to make an e-cookbook. But yeah, it was really dumb. I feel like I got to the end of both of those and was like, okay, why, you know, I didn't even really ask people what they were looking for. And then how do you market that? You know, you have to look at your readers, solve a problem for them, or look at what's a pressing issue, and use that to guide the direction of your book, instead of just like arbitrarily picking what you think is fun to write about or what you think your readers want.
Okay, so it helps guide your book. It helps tell you whether or not you should even write it in the first place.
Yeah, right.
What about for hype, for letting people know, kind of an ad without being an ad?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge, you know, a huge thing that when you're polling people and getting people excited about it, they're thinking, oh, you know, this is a problem, and it kind of becomes a natural, like, it's the start of a sales funnel, you know, even though you're really using that as a helpful thing. I feel like with the ebooks that we've done, it kind of happened by chance with Tasty Food Photography. And like, I'm listening to these podcasts now that are about, cause I'm trying to just learn more after having these two ebooks that are like, okay, they're fine. They're good. I feel good about them, but they're just not selling really, really super well. So trying to be more intentional about how do you produce a good ebook that makes, you know, substantial money. And then I hear things in those podcasts that I did with Tasty Food Photography, or at least semi did without even really knowing it. So it's been interesting to kind of compare notes with that and what I did, and kind of pick out the things that I accidentally did right, and then try to think about how I would use them again in the future to do it right more. So,
you know what? I was going back to see what I did with the first product on Mixergy, and I didn't realize that I did it at the time, but I did that exact thing that you're talking about. Went to the audience and said, I'm thinking of doing this. What would you want to learn? And I remember actually the way I did it. One of the first products was how to create landing pages. And I said, I'm doing this because I want to learn it.
Yeah, right.
If you want to be a part of this, tell me what you want to learn from this program and why you should be a part of it. And that helped me understand what the program should include and who should be included in it.
Yep.
All right. So that would have been the top of your funnel. You did tell April, though, that even though you had a lame start, you did start to build up through what you called mini launches. What are mini launches?
Well, okay, now is this for, what is this in reference to? Is this in reference to Tasty Food?
I'm not sure. It was just something that you happened to say, and so she wrote it down so that I could ask you about. You said, look, the sales page and the blog post is all we did to launch the product. Sales numbers weren't memorable, but it started snowballing since the launch. Then affiliates picked it up, and it started growing when they shared it with their audience, and now we have lots of mini launches from that. Is that not on your site? That means the affiliates were doing mini launches?
No, I think, well, yeah, I mean, I think yes, because anytime an affiliate, you know, picks it up, reads it, and really loves it and does a post, it's like relaunching that into the world. So I feel like what I was trying to say with that is a combination of affiliates constantly like freshly putting it out there, you mm-hmm. know, and putting it in front of people. And then also because it's an ebook and it's an electronic, you know, product, which I love because I can go in and revamp it and change it and add things to it. And then relaunch it, you know.
And when you relaunch after an update, what does that look like today? When you go back in and say, I've learned a few things that I can add to this, I'll add it. Now I want the world to know. Mm-hmm. How do you launch it at that point?
You know, when we did that, because we did it wasn't a major overhaul, but we did a pretty big, you know, update, kind of like the version 2.0 or whatever, about a year ago. And I just did a post on it. And again, it's like, it's kind of embarrassing because I feel like it's a pretty lame launch, but I just did a post on it and talked about the updates and talked about some of the things that were new. And we updated like the cover image, kind of like gave it a new look, updated all the affiliate ads so that it wasn't stale. You know, it wasn't like this is still the same. People see the same little ads everywhere, but just gave it a fresh look. And then also offered it. One thing that we did that I think was good was we offered it to anybody who had bought, you know, could get the updated version just for free. And I don't know how most businesses normally do that, but because of the way we have our sales set up, we decided not to automate that. So like I had to take all the emails and manually send people the new file and stuff. But I think people feeling like they're getting the fresh, you know, new product and then them going out and again, refreshing their own launch. It's kind of like a little waterfall trickle where we, you know, refresh, we make it really good, we make it feel awesome, and then other people, you know, continue to be motivated to share that with their own readers as well.
I see. Wow. And so people who wanted an upgrade would have to email you, and you would have to look and see, did they really buy? Yes, they did. I'll go and get them the document and send it over. Whoa, that's a very manual process. What software were you using to deliver your content in the beginning?
Well, we were using... So we use eJunkie for, you know, distribution of the and sales of the eBooks. And I think the reason that we, if I'm remembering correctly, I think the reason that we didn't just automatically have that go out was because it was going to be insanely expensive to send this file again to all the people through eJunkie. And so, and also I think, you know, not knowing if people are going to want it. I mean, I think that would be the ideal. And at that point, we weren't at a business level where we could say that was really justifiable, but still wanted to provide the best, you know, to people who had been customers. And so that felt like the best option. If we were to do it again, I feel like now we're at a different level of business where it would be worth it to spend a good chunk of money to just have that delivered out to people. But that was kind of how, what felt like the best fit at the time. And I got a lot of emails and I sent out a lot of those eBooks. And, you know, people, I think, appreciated the update and appreciated being able to get the newest and latest and greatest of it. So.
And you're still using eJunkie, right?
We are. Yep. Yep. We use that for all our eBook products. So
let's talk about confidence. You said that that's one of the things that you learned through this process. Do you have an example of where confidence was especially shaky?
I think when we, one particular time that I think of is when we were in the Philippines, you know, whenever you get a negative comment, whenever you're putting yourself out there creatively and you get negative feedback, it's like, there's a little sketch on the oatmeal that shows, you know, I get all these positive comments. Yay. You know, this is great. And then you get one negative and it's like, the world is ending. I am the worst person ever. And so I think I'm really susceptible to, I think I'm just a more sensitive person. And so I can get one negative comment and feel like, ugh.
When did you get more than one negative comment? What was the hardest time?
When we were in the Philippines, there were a few posts that I did where I think I was being a little more vulnerable than I had normally been and just talking about some of the struggles of living there and some of the things I was seeing and thinking and feeling, basically getting more personal than just food and having people respond to that and say, you know, this, that, and the other thing about you're a bad person.
Why would they call you a bad person? What did you feel?
Well, you know, I think I was really processing through a lot in terms of, you know, just living in a different culture and feeling uncomfortable. And I think some of that was me wanting to share that and express that, but having it come out in a way, it's just hard to communicate yourself online clearly. And I think people wanted to come to Pinch of Yum and see, this is awesome. Life living in the Philippines is awesome. And I love everything about it. And kind of like that, like didn't want to, felt like I was maybe like my own negative feelings was a reflection on how I felt about living in the Philippines and how I felt about the Philippines. And so it was really personal and people would send these comments and I would just be really down. And you know, you're alone, you're isolated, you're living abroad. And so you don't have your normal support system. And I can remember that being a really low point and feeling like people hate me as a person. Like they don't just hate my stuff. Like they hate me as a person and having to move past that and say, you know, this is one person's thought. This is a person online who's trying to tell you something about your life. They don't even know you. They don't know. They're not here to talk with you in person. And they're not even interested in dialoguing with you. You know,
I'm looking through their site to see what, I can't believe I missed this in my prep, where you said something that would make people feel uncomfortable that you were not appreciating the Philippines enough, but I don't see it. What was one post?
There was a post that I did that was, I can't remember what the food was, but the premise of the post was like there were kids playing out in the rain and we were outside and we were taking pictures of the kids. I mean, really, for me, it was like wanting to document just like what our neighborhood was and what our life was. And in one part of the post, I made a joke about how part of Pinch of Yum is just like joking and funny and stupid, you know, little sayings and whatever. And yep. So I made this funny comment about, or what I thought was a funny comment about how I'm taking pictures of my kids in my neighborhood and their parents are, you know, thinking, who is this weirdo American who's taking pictures of them? I mean, kind of trying to be self-deprecating, you know, I'm the weirdo who walks around with the big camera, blah, blah, blah. But I think it came across the wrong way. And I think people didn't realize I was joking. And so they said, why are you taking pictures of kids if their parents? And it's like, oh, no. It was a complete misunderstanding. Like I was totally joking, just making fun of myself. You know, they're out there waving at me, but it just totally came across wrong. And then I think even though I knew it was a misunderstanding, it's just such a public personal attack that it's really hard to pick yourself back up and, you know, continue to put yourself out there and be vulnerable and share your real life, share your real stories. So
how do you get back in? Why don't you just say, hey, you know what? Screw it. It's just too difficult. People are never going to get these jokes. I'm going to pull back on being personal here and just focus on the food.
I think I did for a while. You know, I think it was like, okay, I'm not going to talk about stuff anymore because I want to make sure that I'm coming across the right way. But really, I think it comes down to just saying to yourself, these are people, you don't know these people. Don't, like, you can't let, as a creative person and a person who puts yourself out there online, you cannot let people who don't know you and don't, you know anything about your life come in and have a say. It's like having a complete stranger, you know, dictate what you do with your life. So to have literally two or three people come in and say something, and for me to say, okay, now I'm going to not do it anymore and I need to go this direction. It's just when you imagine what it really represents, and that these people don't actually know you, they're complete strangers, and yet they're going to affect the whole course of your, you know, trajectory of where you're taking your business.
How do you get to that? That's a very logical understanding. It's not an easy leap to go from feeling to logic and stick with logic. What allowed you to get the confidence, to regain your confidence?
Well, I mean, for me, honestly, having a kind of like a partner in the whole thing, having Bjork, it was huge. I mean, I don't think that there have been so many times where I've said, okay, that's it, I'm quitting. Like, I'm not going to do it anymore. But having somebody like in my very close life who can say, who can understand what it is and be interested in it. I think
an example of a time when you went to him and said, you know what, this is, I'm suffering here. And he helped see you through it.
I mean, that was a huge time. I remember, you know, and I remember like that was so extreme. It's not really that extreme, but like so extreme to me that like my family was calling and they're like, are you okay?
Oh, I saw this mean
comment.
So what did he say?
He just would say, it's kind of the same things that, you know, I was saying before about, you know, you can't let people online who you don't know, dictate how you feel about yourself. And also he would always encourage me, and this was kind of a good thing for me, but encourage me to follow up with those people. And, you know, a lot of times they didn't email back or they didn't, you know, respond back because they kind of are, you know, the troll kind of mentality people. But to be able to face it and to be able to say, you know, to not back down from it, but to like rise up to it, face it and say, I want to, you know, we might not agree on this, but I'm willing to like look it in the face and I'm willing to say, this is real. Like not to just to leave the comment, not to whatever, but to say, hey, look, I'm sorry you feel that way. This is what I really meant. And I always feel better when I feel like I'm demonstrating this in this interview. I'm so, you know, talkative, but I always do that through like talking about it. I always feel better when I talk about things. So having someone both internally to talk about it with, and then also going back to the source of the tension and at least trying to make it right, helps me to feel better where I at least get to put some kind of word in, you know, and not just have it be a direct.
Boy, that's a dangerous thing to do, to go to a troll and contact them and say, I want to explain to you. I did that in the beginning where I got a lot of negative feedback to my interviews. And I remember contacting people who did, and I just said, I want to learn here. If the fact that you discovered my site means that you care about the startup world, and if you care about the startup world, then you're someone who understands the need for feedback. So you know that when I'm asking you for your feedback, I'm really going to use it. What is it about my interviews that's turning you off? And I remember discovering through those calls, I remember one woman specifically who put a word to it. She said, you know, now that I think about it after this conversation, I think a big part of it is you're coming at business from a very American point of view where you talk openly about money. And every time I hear you talk about money, it makes me feel uncomfortable. Like that is not to be talked about. It's like you were frankly just getting naked on camera. It would make me uncomfortable too. Mm-hmm. And that helped me understand that there, you know, that when you're doing interviews, you're talking to different cultures online, more than just the culture of tech in the city that I happen to be in, but the culture of business all over the world and how people handle it. And I could deal with some negativity on that. And so there's some things that I could say a little bit differently because I want to appeal to people outside the US.
Right.
Did you learn anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just that whole experience and how those comments were so personal and negative, I feel like it made me realize people care and they are reading and they're thinking, and like to go to those people, and I don't even really remember having a meaningful, you know, back and forth where I was like, how could I improve this? And then they responded. I remember that I did, you know, contact them, but to be able to take that and kind of like, I feel like it's this out of body, like it's like you say, okay, I'm going to remove myself emotionally. And maybe for me, you know, it's more difficult than for other people just because I am more sensitive. But to remove myself from it in terms of emotionally and then say to like these people to look at what they're actually saying. And it's like, okay, try to look at it objectively and say, what is it in my writing that's making people feel that way? And maybe I shouldn't do that anymore, you know, and maybe I should think about how I'm not that I should stop, but like think about how I'm saying things. And I really feel like from that point, the post, I hope, got better and stayed, you know, at to a certain point, got to the point where they were as, you know, as maybe as vulnerable as that other one was, but that I was really intentional about the work, you know. It was like not a, it was not a draft and publish. It was like draft, edit, 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 publish, right. You know, where I really made sure that I was communicating myself clearly. And those are, I mean, that's a really valuable thing. So in that way, you know, I'm thankful for that because it helps me to think and pay, really pay attention to the more serious things that I'm saying and how people might, you know, interpret them. So
I agree. And I also think just being open about how we confront the worst feedback we get encourages other people to say things like, someone might email me and say, Andrew, you can get a better sound from your mic if you position it a little bit differently. They know that if I'm paying attention to trolls' feedback, people who are negative and hateful, then I'm clearly open to feedback from everyone. And so they're more likely to give it to me.
Yep.
You then launched Pro, Food Blogger Pro.
Yeah.
I know it's Bjork who's running it. Do we have him scheduled for an interview about how he did it?
No, but
no,
I'm sure
I'd like to have him on. Yeah. I'd love to do it with some kind of revenue milestone to celebrate here.
Yeah.
Even if he doesn't fully announce it here, but announcing it here would be even better. Yeah. I want to understand how he did it because I've got membership sites and I believe strongly in them. They're not overnight hits, but they are worth the effort.
Yep.
So open invitation to him, especially around a big milestone, but just to get an understanding of how you guys figured out what to put in there. Mm-hmm. I thought we can talk about that. How did you know what to put into Food Blogger Pro?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a long time in the development and simmer stage. We had the idea probably a year and a half before we actually got around to starting it. Mm-hmm. It was just on a whim. You know, we were on a walk and we were like, oh my gosh, we should do this. That would be so, you know, we have people emailing asking for help about all these things. It was really stemmed from like an overwhelming number of emails and people saying, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And not being able, just having it not be sustainable or useful to just continue to respond to these people individually. So I think based on the, as far as coming up with the master list, I think it was based on email and also based on the things that we knew. So there are definitely some things that we don't have on, that we could have more on Food Blogger Pro, but if we didn't feel like we fully knew it or had the time to learn it, you know, then we wouldn't have that on there. But like I took the photography, so I mean, I feel like it's an 80-20 where he does 80% of the work and I'm like 20% involved on the forum and creating new courses and stuff. But the photography was all, you know, my thing. And so I took that and kind of broke it down based on how I felt like, you know, it should be taught to people and what would be the easiest to learn. And as far as the other big topics, I think we looked at what are the things in the income reports that people have questions about, what are the things that we get the most emails about, and what are the things that are the most, if you have to get the most bang for your buck, like what is going to be the most helpful to people, you know, when starting a blog? And then
what would you get in the income reports? What kind of questions would come up a lot?
A lot of times people will have specific questions about, you know, ad networks, how ad networks are set up, or they would have questions about, you know, I get a lot of questions about ebooks, not necessarily in the comments, but as far as, I guess somewhat in the comments of those posts, but a lot of it is about the advertising. I mean, it's all monetization stuff for the most part. And so I think taking those questions about advertising, about how the traffic ties into the money and like different times of year, you know, advertising rates go up and down and which networks are best, stuff like that.
Networks are best?
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't think we're necessarily like a part of the best networks, to be honest. I think it changes a lot. And actually it's really interesting because pockets of bloggers have come up where they're, you know, kind of maybe this has been going on forever and I just am out of the loop, but like we'll compile all their data so that we can, you know, look collectively as bloggers, which networks are performing the best. So you don't have to personally try to figure it all out. Right now we're with Blogger, but I don't necessarily think that that's the best. I think that there are probably other networks that are higher paid out there, and we're always looking for.
So how do you resolve a question like that when someone says, I'm signing up because I want to know what network's the best, and there is no universal best, and there definitely isn't a best from year to year? How do you respond to them?
Well, I mean, I think we really try not to oversell like what's going to be given. Like what's going to be given is information that will help you start and grow your blog. But there are, you know, for questions like that, there are no clear cut. Sometimes, a lot of times, there are no clear cut answers. But I think another thing that's helpful in terms of selling it is the community aspect. So it is a combination of people's experiences and you know, their knowledge, basically, from their own experiences with their own blogs that can come together in that forum, that community. And it's been so fun to see it, it's become so active. You know, all these food bloggers, we have like something like maybe five or 600 members right now. And so many people are active on the forum. It's just like, it's really fun to see people sharing that information back and forth. Like, what about this social media network or, social media, you know, what is the word I'm looking for? Like a social media thing.
Site.
This new social site.
Should we use this? Is this the next Pinterest or not?
Right. And then somebody else coming in. So it's not all just us, but it's other people taking their own experiences, to kind of allow people to come to basically just put information out there and not necessarily say, do this and this is the only way, but to just provide people with a wealth of information. And that's kind of how we try to sell it versus we're going to give you the one magic trick, you know, to start your blog or to make money from your blog or whatever.
You know what? So after years of resisting it, I finally created a site about how to interview. It's called interviewyourheroes.com. And it's not open right now, so I'm not promoting it, but I am going to say that I had to wrestle with that question too. There's some answers that change from week to week, and I can't give you a universal truth to that. And frankly, what works for me today won't work for me tomorrow or work for you even today. And I've noticed that because of the forums, people can get other perspectives and see what works, how they could even disagree with me. And I like to see that because it gives people who are in the community other options that come from people who are like them. One thing that helped us get that was, as an experiment, I added points. I didn't even announce it. I just gave points. When people are thanked, they get more points. Uh-huh. And because people are thanked, I noticed that it encourages them to go in and add more value and to teach more. You have anything like that that helped?
No, but I shouldn't say no. Like, we have like a star system. So based on how many times you've posted, you know, your number of stars goes up. But we really, that's a huge thing that we've had on the, you know, it's like on the next big projects thing, is kind of adding that gamification factor to the membership site. And, you know, if you end up doing an interview with Brooke, he would obviously can talk more about that. But like being able to give, you know, little rewards or incentives to people when they, not only when they participate, you know, on the forum, but when they meet certain milestones for their blog. And I think having that kind of like tangible digital, maybe, reward, you know, people, it's inspiring to people and they want to keep doing it. And therefore the site becomes more valuable to them. And so they stay on as members and provide more to other people. It's like a positive, you know, positive cycle. So I think it's really powerful. It's something we've definitely thought, you know,
go
thought
figure.
About.
I mean, not go figure. I mean, I knew it. I just didn't realize it would be that easy to add. And frankly, even for me, it's helpful because I had another community on another site that we created, True Mind, where I couldn't tell who was most active. It's whoever stuck out for me that I would show appreciation to because I could see that they're most active. Right. Here with the points, it's a lot easier for me to see who's most engaged, who's publishing more. And it's not just about who stands out for me. All right. What else do I have? So we talked about confidence. Here's something that I still see that works for you. BuzzFeed. You guys are on BuzzFeed a lot. Are you doing anything to actively get onto BuzzFeed's lists of the best foods for Labor Day, the best foods for a Monday morning, or any of that?
No. I would say no. For we haven't, and that doesn't mean that there isn't a way, you know, to like actively pursue that. But for us with Pinch of Yum, it's been being contacted by those sites. And personally, I mean, I don't know for sure because I haven't asked these people from Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, whatever, they'll email and say, can I use your photo for this and your recipe? And I'm like, yes, please, you know. And usually what I'll say is like, use it. You have my permission forever, you know, by using this link, following the, you know, crediting or whatever that we expect, then just giving them, making it as easy as possible for them to be able to share, you know, Pinch of Yum and kind of get exposure that way. But I do think like, Pinterest and sometimes those food sharing sites, that's where the people who write these articles and curate all the things, that's where they're finding it.
They're going to Pinterest and finding you there, and then they post on their site. Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you're thinking about how does somebody go about writing that article, while they're searching around, you know, they're doing a Google search, maybe a Google image search, maybe also, you know, a search on Pinterest. And so and again, this is just like my thinking about it. I don't have any, like, it's not like the person who emailed me from BuzzFeed said, I found you on Pinterest or anything like that. But I think the more little, you know, places that your content exists on the web and that people can find it, the greater the chances that somebody is going to find it who writes for BuzzFeed or who writes for Huffington Post. And then to be able to get, you know, publicity that way.
I just did a site : buzzfeed.com/pinchofyum.com search.
Yeah.
I see 70 results. It's 24 indulgent ways to celebrate National Garlic Day. 20, 27 reasons cauliflower deserves your love and loyalty. By the way, the cauliflower one is a photo of a food with a link to your site to get the recipe, and then another photo of someone else's food, link to their site to get the recipe. So it's terrific links, because it's the specific kind of person who likes your food enough to want to come over and actually read the recipe.
Right.
27 delicious paleo recipes for this. All of them have numbers. 24 mind-blowing ways to eat crepes. I don't want to click it. I don't want my mind blown right now. Yeah. But it's huge for you. And you mentioned that they're searching for you online and finding you. Seems like search engine optimization, I noticed even early on as I looked through your posts, was something you started to pay attention to. How much work are you putting into SEO?
You know, I think for us SEO, for me anyways at this point, it's not necessarily like now we do our SEO work. It's just embedded into the different things that we do for every post. So I have a little checklist that I go through for each post, and it's like putting in the approach. It's like originally naming the image, which sometimes I even still like don't go back and look. I feel like I'm not sure, you know, that they would all be perfect, but trying to really remember to name the images appropriately to your search term, and putting in the title text and the alt text. And then we use Yoast as our SEO plugin.
The plugin.
Yes, SEO plugin. And so that's super slick. And that's when we switched over to WordPress, we really hadn't had any kind of SEO anything when we were on Tumblr. So when we switched over to WordPress, actually, I don't remember if that was right when we switched over or if it was when we did the site redesign. And then we added that that plugin. And I had to actually go back, because we haven't been always paying attention to SEO. So I had to go back to post number one out of 600 and go put in all the keywords and put in the, you know, the SEO.
See, so you have the checklist. The checklist says if we have a photo, name it properly, not photo 123 or whatever the camera gives you, but mind-blowing way to eat crepe. I don't know what it is.
Right.
And then the alt tag. Then the URL, I imagine, is also on the checklist. Yep. What else is on the checklist?
I mean, those are really the biggies, but also with Yoast, you know, it makes it so slick because it shows me, it basically gives me a grade for every post of, you know, and it's so slick. It's like, so it's SEO for dummies. It's perfect for me. So like, I can see how many times I said the word in my post. So this is just a little thing, but like, I always make sure that anytime I reference the recipe within my writing, because I write pretty long posts. And so anytime I reference it, I don't just call it like the crisp or the dessert. Like I call it the full term that I want it to be, the blueberry crisp or the whatever with whatever sauce. And I put the whole name in. And that's something that I didn't always do, but I've tried to do more because, you know, when they give you that little tracker thing and it says, how many times have you, you know, how many times has this search term happen in your post? And then you're like, oh, sweet, 20 times or whatever, you know, and then you know that it just gives you a little bit of a
I don't remember the tracker. Let me see where the tracker is. I'm going to go to my interview links. This is fantastic. I'm learning a lot here. And then I want to ask you about the final question.
Yeah.
Where is that? The track.
I see it's just like a list of the different things. And it'll say like, do you have it in your, you know, it shows a number after, do you have it in the URL? Do you have it in the title? Do you have it in the, how many times does it occur in your post? And that's the one I really pay attention to. How many times does it occur in your post? Especially because I am already writing such long posts that it's like, why not at least get 20 of those words to be my particular search term that I'm going for. So
I see page analysis.
And another, you know, another thing that I do is I use Google Trends, like a trend search. And so I'll search keywords if I'm trying to decide what to name it. I a lot of times on the front end of publishing a recipe or developing it, I will go and search. So like an example would be like, at Thanksgiving time, I made like a corn pudding thing. And so I searched like corn pudding, corn pie, corn porridge, all the different things that I could name it to see which one it has the highest, you know, searchability. Uh-huh. And then I use that as my title. So I do that quite a bit too.
You know, I'm so glad that I asked you about that. I wouldn't have realized that you did so much, except I saw in older posts where you taught other people about search engine optimization and the importance of it. And anyway, I'm glad I asked. All right, let's finish up by saying this. We talked about the confidence that you got through doing this. We talked about your understanding of, two things.
Yep.
Before I get to the last question, books. April asked you if you have any books to recommend, and you had these good ones. One of them was Steal Like an Artist, a graphic book.
Yeah.
Why did you recommend that one?
I really like that because I think as a person who creates and like is creating quote unquote original stuff, mm-hmm. it's just helpful to see, I can't remember who the author is on that now, but
is it Austin Kleton?
Yes, that's okay. Who it is. And he has so many graphics and little like easy to consume things that feel like, oh, this is me, like the life of a project graph. And just to realize that some of the things that you're feeling as a creative are like, this is a normal thing to have the life of the project be so exciting at the beginning and then be like, I wish I would have never done this, you know, right before you finish it or whatever. And also I think just in terms of thinking about your own original work and defining originality and mm-hmm. defining like how do creatives continue to be original, even though we know that originality, it's such a subjective kind of thing because...
Did you have an issue where you felt like what you're doing wasn't original enough?
No, I mean, I think always. I think like with food, any food combination, like somebody's already found it. There's nothing that I'm like inventing necessarily. But I think for me, it's like redefining how I think about originality and that for what's original is the content that I'm creating, but not necessarily the food combination or the ingredient combination, but how I write, how I take my photos, and how I put it all together in a post. I mean, that's an original work. Like nobody else, you know, has done that, what I just did. But I think it's important to acknowledge that like I'm not necessarily an inventor of new food combinations. Like even if I don't realize and I think I'm inventing it, maybe I saw it somewhere else and that, you know, came back into my mind without realizing it or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder how many people gave up.
What's that?
I wonder how many people gave up on the whole food blogging thing, partially because they thought there was no revenue in it, and the other part because they think, well, I can't do anything new. There are already so many other people out there instead of thinking what you just said.
Definitely. Yeah, I get a lot of emails about that.
The second book, but I'm looking at my schedule. We're clearly over time. I'll wrap this up in a moment for the audience, but I've got so many questions to ask you. I'm learning a lot from this interview. Tribes is a second book that you recommended.
Yeah.
How do you use what Seth Godin wrote in that book to create a community that's more than just a bunch of hits to your site?
Yeah, I think, one thing that we're always thinking about is not just having people who bop in for a recipe and then we never see them again, but really that kind of goes back to what I was saying before about sharing story, sharing life and personality along with the brand and trying to like bring people around something which is, you know, like a person or an idea or like a flavor of, you know, the brand, so to speak. So I think for me, how I see that is not just making a recipe site, but making it personal, like making it a blog, making it, this is the community, this is the style of the site, the style of the writing. It's a person behind it. And it's not just a generic recipe site because recipes are a dime a dozen. They're on every corner of the internet. But thinking of what's something special that's going to make people come back to my site.
Here's what I think is you've done there. Tell me if I've got this right.
Yeah.
You make people, or you don't make them, but what you do is designed to get people to know you so they root for you. The income statements, you can see people root for you to do better month after month. The posts are more about you personally, and they lead us to root for you to succeed with this new pro site, with this recipe, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think like starting, I don't think we would get the same response if we would have started the income reports 2 years in when we were making a not embarrassing amount of money.
Right.
You know, I think it's like when you start out, you're vulnerable, you put yourself out there and you're like, hey, this is embarrassing, but we made 20 bucks this month and here's how we did it and here's what we're going to try next month. Then people, you know, it's real and it's a little bit vulnerable. And I think people appreciate that vulnerability and come around you more and want to support that. So,
We didn't get to email list, but we've talked about it in other interviews. That's important for you, even though Pinterest is so powerful. Let's finish up with this.
Yep.
We talked about your growth as a person through this business. confidence that you've developed, your ability to share your ideas, your ability to run it. Let's talk about an external benefit, which is something, a major purchase that you made recently. What is it? The house.
Oh, geez. I was like, what is it?
I was wondering, how do I tee that up so that you get to reveal it and not me? And then I said, you know what? Let's just say the house.
Oh my gosh. Yes. We just bought a house. So we actually, I don't know if this is what I had talked to April about before, but we bought this house with the intent of redoing the kitchen too, to have it be, you know, something that we could use for the blog and the business. And then we're like, no, let's go get a studio. Let's do the studio instead. And now we're back to redoing the kitchen. So anyways, we have this little house that we just bought. It's an old house and it's in St. Paul, and we're gonna be knocking out walls pretty soon here and making a little studio kitchen, I guess. But redoing that and getting that all ready for videos, starting to do some videos for Pinch of Yum, and also just having a better space for me to work in. So
congratulations on doing that, and congratulations on the business. The site, for anyone out there who's listening, first of all, I always say, if you find a way to connect with the guest, the first thing you should do is say thank you. If you get any value, it's always helpful to say thank you. And if you want to see the site and how you can connect and say thank you, just go to pinchofyum.com, pinchofyum.com. And if you're not into the recipes, you will be once you click around. And if you're still looking for more and looking for the business part, click that income link. I think you'll learn a lot from following that. Thank you so much, Lindsay. Thanks for doing this interview.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.